you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, a live literary event series from LAist. We are back with guests, author Amanda Montell, and actor Bella Lavelle. You can find us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum. Tickets at laist.com/events.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Very good to have you with us this morning. Police in Golden, Colorado say they still do not have a motive determined for the rampage that killed 10 people at that King Super supermarket yesterday afternoon. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we'll have the very latest details on what law enforcement is attempting to learn about this terrible attack. But right now, we turn our attention to COVID-19, where the news has been looking up day by day. Joining us to talk about where we stand from UCLA School of Public Health, epidemiologist and professor of medicine, Dr. Timothy Brewer. Dr. Brewer, it's such a pleasure to have you back with us.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I want to thank you again for this year-long process of you being so willing to be with us weekly to share your expertise. It's much appreciated, and I hear daily from listeners who are so thankful. So we appreciate it and just want you to know how appreciated you are.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's start first with some concerning news from the U.S. FDA that AstraZeneca's vaccine data of its U.S. clinical trials, the FDA is concerned that there may be some out-of-date data that is included in the submission. Can you tell us what the concern is?
So it's a breaking news story, so we're still learning, but apparently what happened was the AstraZeneca announced the data based on their planned interim trial results from February 17th, which showed 79% efficacy. And then the Data Safety and Monitoring Board said, well, wait a minute, we actually have additional data from after February 17th, and you should include that as well, which suggests that the overall efficacy may be closer to the range of 65 to 75% rather than 79%.
And how significant is that difference? Does that lower degree of efficacy make it more challenging to get emergency use authorization here?
Not necessarily, because the target was 60%. So both of those numbers are over 60%. I think what's really unusual in this situation, Larry, is this is all playing out in public, and normally what would happen is the Data Safety and Monitoring Board would contact the company privately, and there would be a discussion, and they would come to some consensus.
All right. And what are the implications for so much of the world where the AstraZeneca vaccine is the primary or only vaccine being offered?
So, again, hard to know at this point, because what we'd really like to see is the breakout of the data for how well does it protect against death, hospitalization, and serious disease. And so far, most of our vaccines have held up pretty well on those criteria, even when they haven't necessarily prevented mild or moderate disease.
So you would still be hopeful that even if it's the only vaccine, as long as it's widely administered, that it will control the spread in those countries?
Exactly. So we have good data that it seems to work well against the UK variant, what's known as B.1.1.7. And then there was a recent study out of South Africa published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, which suggested that it was not effective in preventing mild or moderate disease from the B.1.351 variant in South Africa. So I think we just need to see the data to really know where do we stand with this and our other vaccines against the different variants.
I wonder, though, if this means that there are going to be many doses of AstraZeneca that end up being delayed or unused because there's already been some reluctance in the European Union to use it. There was the hold for a few days because of concerns about blood clots that were later found to be unrelated to the AstraZeneca vaccine. But I just wonder if sort of, you know, bit by bit, these pieces of news undermine public confidence in taking this one.
I think you're exactly right. I think that's a very big concern, and it will be a challenge for rolling this vaccine out. And yet we still need it. Not only do we have shortages within the United States, but globally, there are many countries that haven't even started vaccinating any of their citizens at all. And we need to get a better job of getting vaccine more widely distributed around the world.
And what are the reasons for that? Are these countries that have delayed requesting the vaccine or have put in requests and they're at the bottom of the list with the various pharmaceutical companies? Do we know what the challenge is?
Well, it's twofold. So one is just production, how fast can you make the vaccine? But the second, unfortunately, is nationalism. And so a number of countries, the United States included, have prohibited exporting vaccine until their own citizens are vaccinated. And as Director General of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom said, you know, we really have to vaccinate the entire world if we want to stop this pandemic. We can't just focus on vaccinating the countries where the vaccines are made.
And you look now at it's about 14%, I think, of the American adult population that has been fully vaccinated, have had both of their shots. Would you have thought that here, you know, third week of March, that we'd be at this point?
Yeah, I'm hoping that we'll continue to ramp up both in our supply and our ability to vaccinate. One of the things I found a little discouraging is that here in Los Angeles County, we have the capacity to vaccinate over 600,000 people, and yet we only had enough vaccine to vaccinate about 300,000 people. So hopefully supply will continue to ramp up to meet the needs of both our population and other populations around the world.
We're joined today by Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist and professor of medicine at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health. Dr. Brewer has served on the advisory boards of the aforementioned World Health Organization, as well as the National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. If you have questions for Dr. Brewer about COVID-19 or about the vaccination process, about the vaccines themselves, as we do this every day on Air Talk, we bring you the very latest information at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also ask your question via Twitter at AirTalk. You can also post on the AirTalk Facebook page or post on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org and let us know what you think. One thing I wanted to ask you about was a piece I read in the Wall Street Journal by Jeremy Devine, in which he was raising the issue of what's called long COVID or long haulers who suffer significant symptoms months after they had seemingly recovered or didn't really ever have a full recovery from COVID-19. And the point that he makes in this piece is that there's a particular advocacy group that's behind the research on this, and that they also advocate on behalf of patients identified with things like chronic fatigue syndrome and Lyme disease and other things where there are questions about to what degree, if any, is there a psychological component in the perception or the reality of symptoms. And I just wonder your thoughts about this, and what do you think we know about the long COVID symptoms, and how do you think we should consider it at this point?
So, complicated issue, and there are a couple of different factors there. So let's start with some data. One of the things we know is that we now have studies to show that people who have been hospitalized with COVID-19 if you start to follow them months out, continue to have symptoms like chest pain, dizziness, palpitations, and some neurologic symptoms as well. It's been described as sort of a brain fog. We also know from a study done here in California that if you look at non-hospitalized patients, this was done out of UC Irvine where they looked at medical records, that some proportion of them, even people who have been asymptomatic but have documented COVID infection, will go on to develop some of these same symptoms. At the same time, there are a number of people who have not had documented COVID infection, think they may have had COVID, and are complaining of these symptoms. And the question is, are we really dealing with one problem or multiple different problems?
All right, we'll continue with Dr. Timothy Brewer, our guest with us on Air Talk today. We'll be taking your questions about COVID-19 at 866-893-5722. You can tweet at Air Talk, post on the Air Talk Facebook page, or post on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
So glad to have you with us on Air Talk, the very latest on COVID-19, with Dr. Timothy Brewer joining us from UCLA School of Public Health. Dr. Brewer, as we were coming up on the break, we were talking about the long COVID symptoms, and you were saying we're still trying to figure out in individual cases whether this is COVID later on down the road or might be other illnesses. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that challenge of determining that.
So you're exactly right, Larry. So what we know is that people are not well, and the question is why? And that, as someone who's been practicing medicine for 30 years, that can be extremely difficult to tease out exactly what's going on. And it's frustrating both for the patients, their families, and the healthcare workers, because you can't necessarily do a test and say, aha, this is the problem. And you just have to keep working with the patients to try to really understand where they are and figure out what you can do to try to get them better. But not all of this will be COVID, but some of it certainly will.
We have some other listener questions. Judy in Playa del Rey, wondering if the UK variant of COVID-19 is causing severe symptoms or more severe symptoms for people vaccinated with Moderna or Pfizer. Do we know? And I'm not sure if she means people who would have been exposed to the UK variant at the time, or if they were having it before they were vaccinated. I'm not quite sure.
So what we know about the UK variant and the vaccines is that the vaccines are very effective against the UK variants, which is good because that's probably the most transmissible or easiest to spread variant right now circulating around the world and is increasing in the United States. But at least right now, the vaccines seem to remain very effective against that particular variant. There are some data to suggest that it may cause more serious disease in unvaccinated individuals, but that's still not clear.
And I think what her question was about the, after you receive particularly the second dose of the vaccine, how people will have sometimes a day or two of some difficult to deal with symptoms in some cases, whether exposure to the UK variant has any effect on that.
On side effects, not that we know of. In fact, what we do know is that people who have had documented COVID infection before and then get either Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine have a very vigorous immune response, so that after one dose, it's essentially the equivalent of two doses in someone who hasn't previously had COVID. That having been said, always get your second dose if you've got either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine.
We have a question. I'm not sure whether this is in your area of expertise, Dr. Brewer, but Alicia asks specifically about garment workers and when factory workers are going to be prioritized for getting vaccinated. Do you have any information? We certainly have people that are emergency services responders, people who are doing, retail work, but about those in the garment industry, do we know?
So I'm not aware of anything specific in the garment industry. However, right now, anyone who is a worker who has a comorbid disease should talk with their healthcare provider, because as you probably know, on March 15th, the state changed the recommendation. Anyone over the age of 16 who's at higher risk for serious disease from COVID-19 is now eligible to be vaccinated. So if you have high blood pressure, diabetes, other medical problems, talk with your healthcare provider because you may be eligible to be vaccinated now.
Alicia wants to point out that many of the garment workers were very early on making masks, face coverings for people when we had that intense shortage very early in the pandemic. And I'm glad you brought that up, Alicia, and we appreciate the workers who did that and set aside other things to make those masks. Ivy in Altadena asks, are there any pre-existing conditions or anything that we know about kids who have developed that rare MIS-C, multisystem inflammatory syndrome, which has sometimes occurred for children getting COVID-19?
So I'm not aware of any preconditions. That would be a good question to ask a pediatric infectious disease specialist, because I don't work with kids. But as far as I know, no.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael in Mar Vista says, I'm contemplating going to France in May. Will my being fully vaccinated protect me from the new variants? Michael said he's got the Moderna vaccine.
So, Michael, what we know is that the vaccine seemed to be very effective against the UK variant, and that's the primary variant spreading in Europe at the moment. However, all of the vaccines seem to be less effective against both the South Africa and the Brazil variants. And so the concern is whether or not those two variants will spread globally. Vaccines do seem to prevent serious disease, hospitalization, and deaths, even with those variants, but all of the vaccines are clearly less effective against those two variants.
Dr. Brewer, to what extent do you think this 14% of American adults fully vaccinated, and the percentage, of course, quite higher than that for those who've had first dose, how much of that do you think is coming into play with the fairly stable lower rates of COVID we're seeing?
So I think it's certainly helping. Where it's probably playing out more is in locations that were hit particularly hard, like Los Angeles County. So if you look at the Los Angeles County data, our numbers are still coming down, right? So we're under 2% test positivity now. We're about 500 cases a day, well below where we were at the beginning of January. We've had about 3.2 million people who've gotten one dose of vaccine. We've had about a million people who've gotten two doses. Another 1.2 million people have had reported COVID, and probably another 2+ million people who had COVID and were not diagnosed. So we may actually be getting close to that herd immunity level here in Los Angeles County. Country as a whole, we probably still have a ways to go before we're there.
In the European countries that are seeing a resurgence of COVID-19, do you largely attribute that to the delay in vaccination and that they're trailing in their percentage of a vaccinated population to what we see here or the UK?
I think it's unclear what's going on exactly in Europe. So we know that in Italy, for example, they're having a fairly substantial surge, averaging about 25,000 cases a day. Yet in Spain and the United Kingdom, two countries that were hit very hard, their numbers are still coming down. France and Germany are somewhere in between. I suspect in the UK, it's probably the vaccinations are playing an important role because they were very aggressive at rolling out the AstraZeneca vaccine and are ahead of most other countries in Europe. But exactly what's happening in Italy and some of the other countries is a little unclear at this point.
But there's no evidence to suggest that people who've been vaccinated are getting sick in Italy.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Also wanted to ask you, Dr. Brewer, about Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Say they've tested more than 4,000 recently diagnosed patients who were given a two-antibody combo drug Regeneron developed and found it cut the risk of hospitalization or death by 70%. All of the 4,000 in the study were outpatients and at risk of developing serious illness, either because of their age or other health conditions such as obesity or high blood pressure. The drug also cut the median recovery time from 14 days to 10, and the drug's benefits were similar at half the dose currently allowed in the U.S. under emergency use provisions. This study has not yet been peer-reviewed, but Dr. Brewer, this sounds like a very positive preliminary finding on treating people with COVID.
No, that's exactly right. And now this is the third in a series of studies that have looked at individuals who are at high risk for hospitalization. So they tend to be older, have comorbid disease, have documented COVID-19 infection, and then were either given monoclonal antibody preparations or were given convalescent plasma. And in both situations, both the convalescent plasma, which has antibodies against COVID-19 in it, or the manufactured monoclonal antibodies were effective in reducing the risk of hospitalization in those who got them. But the key there was they were given early on in disease before people got sick.
All right. Dr. Brewer, we appreciate it so much. Thank you, as always, for joining us. I look forward to talking with you hopefully next week.
Thank you very much for having me.
Epidemiologist, professor of medicine at UCLA School of Public Health, Dr. Timothy Brewer, one of our tremendous panel of experts.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com.
Democracy needs to be heard.
This is Michelle Martin from NPR's Morning Edition. It's a fact. Local journalism fuels democracy. When local news thrives, so does civic participation. LAist and NPR are committed to keeping you and your community informed. But we can't do that without your support. Democracy needs you, and so do we. So please become a member now at laist.com/give.
The consultancy McKinsey and Company looked at black workers in American corporations and looked at their underrepresentation in the highest paying industries and came to some conclusions about what's happening at those businesses and what the reasons are that we're not seeing as as people move up the corporate ladder, African Americans being represented anywhere near the level that they are in entry-level jobs, in which their representation is much closer to their overall numbers in the population. Joining us me is the co-author of the McKinsey report, Race in the Workplace, the Black Experience in the U.S. Private Sector, Monet Williams. She's a partner at McKinsey & Company Management Consulting. Thank you so much, Ms. Williams. We appreciate your being with us today.
Glad to be here with you, Larry.
So let's talk first of all about sort of the trajectory that we see in these jobs. To what degree are Black Americans represented at the entry-level positions? And then what happens as you start moving up in the various levels of corporate America?
In our research, we found that Black workers are represented above what you would expect to see in terms of population at the frontline level. So we see about 19% representation there. But then you get down to the entry-level jobs, and we see about a 12% population for Black workers there. And those look pretty good. But to your point, once you start looking a little closer at the overall trajectory is where we see some concerns. In fact, we think it will take about 100 years in order to reach that 12% representation across all levels, if we stay on the current path that we're on today.
In interviews you conducted with Black employees at different companies, what was their perception of the biggest barriers to moving up within the companies?
A lot of people that we talked to during those interviews also mentioned this drop-off from entry-level jobs to manager roles. So being able to get promoted to that first manager level in organizations felt like a big unlock for folks, and it wasn't happening as much as they hoped it would, which was limiting their ability to advance to those further positions in the pipeline as well.
And how does gender play into this? If we have, parents having to deal with childcare issues, perhaps a lack of childcare, making it more difficult, among many other challenges with being able to move up in companies. Do we know to what degree those other economic or household challenges factor into the workplace?
We know from some of the other research that we conduct, Women in the Workplace, which is another report we do, that for the first time, we see some serious discrepancies in the number of women who are contemplating leaving the workforce versus men. In fact, that number is about one in four. So a pretty significant view of people who are feeling the challenges today in terms of combined childcare with your additional work responsibilities. When we look at the Black population that we researched in this report, we didn't look at that split specifically, but we did see that gender parity is near equal for Black workers. And so one of the things that companies can think about going forward is what are the specific things that they can do to really support Black women who are, near 50% of the working population, as we think about progressing people through that pipeline as well.
I guess one of the things I was wondering with single parents, is there a bias that some of these corporations have about the childcare duties, the responsibilities of single parents? And has that perception hurt the ability, particularly of Black women, to move up?
It's a great question. And again, in the Women in the Workplace research, we do see that both women are more likely to report that they have considered leaving due to the additional responsibilities, especially during this time where people have been working in hybrid models or working remotely and schools have been closed. We also see that Black women are thinking about it even more. And we see that mothers are thinking about it even more. So when you look at Black women, they certainly are in a situation where they are seeing three of these factors and probably impede their ability to stay comfortably in the workforce unless companies take a different strategy to support them.
We're talking with the co-author of the management consulting firm McKinsey & Company's Race in the Workplace Report, The Black Experience in the U.S. Private Sector, Monet Williams, partner at McKinsey, joining us. And if you've had a chance to perhaps look at the study in the few weeks that it's been out so far and have any reaction to it, I would be interested to hear your thoughts. We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also post on the AirTalk Facebook page, tweet at AirTalk, or post on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. One of the findings of your study was that mentoring could be a tremendous help, as well as having role models, people who within a company are African American in positions of leadership. So, and you also, if I'm not mistaken, found a significant gap between what companies thought they were doing in the way of mentoring versus actually executing that strategy. And I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. And we talked about both mentorship and sponsorship in this report. And mentorship is more of the traditional providing guidance or counsel to employees. And sponsorship is more active in that you're helping to create opportunities and helping those employees chart a path within the organization. And what we saw in this research is that 87% of the companies who participated reported having a sponsorship program, but only about one third of Black workers reported having a sponsor, and less than a quarter reported feeling like they had a lot of support to advance. So organizations are spending resources and time creating these programs, but we're losing something in terms of effectiveness when we actually talk to the Black workers who are experiencing these programs and participating in them.
And do, from your study, is it understood why there's that that gap, that the lack of consistency?
I think there are at least two pieces we've seen in this research. One is that often sponsors are matched with employees. So you're in one group, I'm in another, maybe you and I went to the same undergrad, and so they match us as a sponsor and sponsoree pair. It's hard sometimes in those situations for the sponsor and sponsoree to make connections because there was no natural work that they're doing together or opportunities for the sponsor to see the sponsoree's work up close. So many organizations are rethinking how they do those pairings. And the other piece we've seen is what you mentioned before. So lack of having some of these Black senior leaders and organizations who can provide that role. Many of the people we interviewed discussed once they worked with a Black leader, that person was able to translate feedback, help them navigate the organization and explain things to them in a way that was more actionable and easier to implement. And so they were relying on the support and guidance of those Black leaders pretty heavily in the early parts of their career.
We're talking with Monet Williams, partner, McKinsey & Company management consulting firm. She's the co-author of the report, Race in the Workplace, The Black Experience in the U.S. Private Sector. Is there any strata of managerial positions where we see Black representation increase? Or as you get higher up, does it decrease pretty consistently along the way?
It decreases pretty consistently along the way. I think one bright spot in what we're seeing here, though, is companies have spent more time focusing on increasing the numbers of the most senior Black representatives in companies. And we tend to see that be more stable over time. So after Black employees make manager, they are much more likely to stay within the companies and continue to move up. And so the biggest intervention point from our perspective is really getting more people that first promotion from entry level to manager.
Ms. Williams, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us and elaborating on this study that you co-led. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Monet Williams of McKinsey & Company, management consulting firm. We have a link to the report Race in the Workplace on our AirTalk page. So appreciate your support on Air Talk. It's wonderful to have you with us each and every day on KPCC. The terrible attack that occurred yesterday in Boulder, Colorado, is the continuing source of an in-depth investigation from federal and local law enforcement. A 21-year-old man who lives in the Denver suburb of Arvada has been identified as the suspect in the case. 10 people are dead, including a Boulder police officer. Police Chief Maris Herold of Boulder said during a news conference this morning she lives just 3 blocks up the street from the King Super supermarket where the mass killing occurred. And 51-year-old Eric Talley was the first officer to arrive at the scene.
Yeah, I feel numb. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to talk to victims, their families. You know, it's tragic. This officer had 7 children, ages 5 to 18. I just had that officer's whole family in my office 2 weeks ago to give him an award. And so it is personal. This is my community. I live here.
That's a Boulder Police Chief Maris Herold talking about the tragedy in her community yesterday and the ongoing investigation with the very latest details. Joining us from Colorado Public Radio, reporter Natalia Navarro. Natalia, thank you very much for being with us. What are we learning over the course of these past few hours?
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me. We just had a arrest affidavit go live from the police department just a few minutes ago. So we've learned a little bit more about the alleged shooter. Like you said, he is 21 years old and from a nearby suburb. He went to high school there. His public criminal history is sparse, but it would not have been enough to prohibit him from owning a firearm. According to these documents, he was armed with what they call a patrol rifle, and he opened fire in the parking lot and then inside the King Supers grocery store on Table Mesa Drive yesterday. He was booked into jail just before 11 a.m. this morning on multiple counts of first-degree murder, and the documents say he purchased an AR-556 pistol on last Tuesday, which is the same day as the Georgia killing. It's an assault-type rifle that resembles an AR-15.
And there was a man who was handcuffed who was removed from the supermarket yesterday, shirtless and bloodied. Have police identified whether that was the suspect or someone else?
Police have not given a specific timeline there, so we're not sure whether that was the suspect himself or someone else. We do know, though, that the suspect did receive a wound to his leg and was treated at a local hospital.
And last I heard, they thought there was a good chance he would be released from the hospital and put into detention today. Do we have any word on whether he has been released yet?
Yeah, just about just over an hour ago, he was booked into Boulder County Jail. That's
okay,
correct.
So the booking was concurrent with that you were describing. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And can you share with us the different law enforcement agencies who are on scene combing both the supermarket as well as engaging in a background investigation to attempt to determine the motive for the crime?
Yeah, of course, Boulder County officers are there. Boulder police officers are there. There are also state law enforcement present. And also the FBI is helping with the investigation.
All right. And do we have a sense of how many people are involved in that investigation? It just looked like it from the video at the scene. It was a huge response.
Yeah, there was a huge response of officers to the area yesterday. It was just swarmed with officers and armed vehicles, et cetera. At this point, we know that it's around, 50. I couldn't give a more specific number than that, but there are quite a few people involved in this investigation.
And, the other issue, of course, we're talking about is motive. And do we have any sort of description of the state of mind of the suspect in this case or a potential motive for the crime?
No, police have not released any information about a possible motive. Some people who knew the man who is the suspect remembered him as troubled, but not someone they would have suspected would act on his aggression in such a horrifying way.
You mentioned he went to high school in suburban Denver. Do we know the kind of work that the suspect has been engaged in the years since high school?
I don't have that information right now, no. But we do know he was involved in wrestling program at the high school, which is Arvada West High School. And that's about it.
All right. And you know, with this rocking this community of Boulder, one of the things that I've heard over and over again from residents is the perception of how safe a community Boulder is, that even with a couple of terrible mass killings in the state of Colorado previously, it just didn't think this would come to Boulder. Can you elaborate a bit on the city and the city's perception of itself?
Yeah, Boulder is very close to Denver, but it really is its own community in itself. It's a lot of people who are very outdoorsy, very socially conscious, and the death toll of this event is just astounding for the city. It exceeds the number of murders in the last 9 years combined. So people do really feel safe in Boulder. So this is shaking a lot of people.
And I saw the age of the victims ranged from 20 to 65, so a very broad range. Do we know whether University of Colorado students were among those who were shopping at the time?
It's not clear at this point. There are two or three victims who were in college range who could have been, but we don't know specifically.
All right. And what anything else you can just share about how this is affecting the greater Denver community, particularly in a state that has endured two previous mass killings of people at a movie theater and at a high school?
Yeah, it's very difficult. We're all receiving texts and calls from across the country checking in to see if we're safe. But it's really becoming a common thread, a common experience for people who live in Colorado. It is definitely bringing up a lot of old feelings about those previous major mass shootings that have happened in the last few years. This is the second big one that I've covered since I've lived here in Denver.
Gun control came to the fore with comments from members of Congress, and even President Biden in his brief remarks earlier urged the passage of two gun control measures passed by the House of Representatives. I wonder, though, you know, in Colorado, sort of the view of gun control, because you've got obviously urban residents who might be more favorable toward it, but also people who live in more rural areas, hunters and the like, outdoors people. Can you sort of characterize the split on gun control in the state?
Yeah, I think you described it pretty well. Colorado does have this very stark divide between urban and rural often, and the urban parts of the state being more blue and the rural ones more red. So it's really unclear what is going to come out of this, but there has been a lot of discussion over gun control after past mass shootings, and I expect that definitely to continue in the state legislature and also in local governments as we move forward.
Natalia, thank you so much for being with us and providing your reporting, as you've been doing, of course, for Colorado Public Radio. Appreciate your taking the time to talk with our listeners here in Southern California.
Thank you again for having me.
Thank you. Natalia Navarro, reporter with Colorado Public Radio, who's been closely following this terrible story. Again, yesterday, Boulder, Colorado, the supermarket where the shooting occurred. This, of course, just, on the heels of the mass killings at three massage parlors in the greater Atlanta area. But yesterday in Boulder, authorities believe it is just a sole gunman who entered that supermarket, killed 10 people, including a Boulder police officer, and a suspect is in custody and has been booked in that case, a 21-year-old man from Arvada, a Denver suburb. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll, of course, be keeping you updated on the events in Boulder throughout the course of the day via NPR News, our top-of-the-hour newscasts, and of course at 1 o'clock this afternoon, All Things Considered with Austin Cross, the very first afternoon feed of the day from NPR.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm Julia Paskin, your host for Weekend Edition on LAist. It is my job to get you the news every Saturday and Sunday morning so you can start your day engaged and informed, even on the weekend. But this place is too big and interesting to stay home, so I'm here to motivate you to explore LA from the best hikes to the most interesting events. I'll bring you the stories and the people behind them.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
We continue with our series, State of the Arts in Los Angeles, in which we look at theater, museums, movie production, musical performances. When are they returning to stages and under what conditions? Today, our focus is on live theater here in Southern California, and I'm so pleased to have such a terrific panel that's joining us. Megan Pressman, who is the managing director and CEO of Center Theater Group, which operates, of course, the Amundsen, the Taper, and the Douglas Theaters. We also have with us from Orange County, the managing director and co-CEO of South Coast Repertory, Paula Tomai. We're so pleased to have with us from the Roby Theater Company, the co-founder, CEO, and producing artistic director of the Roby, Ben Guillory. The Roby's an African-American theater arts organization and part of the Los Angeles Theater Center in downtown Los Angeles. And also very pleased to have with us from the Geffen Playhouse in Westwood, executive director Gil Cates Jr. I had the pleasure of interviewing his father on so many times about earlier years at the Geffen in Westwood. Thank you all so much for joining us. Megan Pressman, let me begin with you, because yours is the largest of the operations here. What sorts of logistical challenges do you face with hiring and COVID protocols and everything, even when you get the word that you are able to return to live onstage productions?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be on. What a way to join, though. That's the tough question. I appreciate the chance to speak to it, though.
Yeah.
It's kind of where we're thinking all the time. Right now, with the projects we're doing, which are kind of digital filmed work and some performances out and about in LA, COVID protocols are costing anywhere from 25 to 30% above and beyond our typical budget. So that's only going to get greater, we know, when we get back into the rehearsal room and the theater. So we're trying to figure out how to calculate those without guidelines yet, which is part of the trouble that we're having in trying to imagine reopening, is not quite sure what to plan for in terms of artist and audience safety and protocol. But it's before we even get there, the timeline issue is really tricky for us. You know, we laid off, unfortunately, about 100 folks of our full-time staff, in addition to a couple hundred people who work on a show-by-show basis. And while we hope to be able to rehire as many of the folks who we laid off as we can, we know a lot of those folks have moved on to other jobs. Many have moved a lot. This is a very typical pandemic story right now. So when we think about hiring timelines, we're looking at anywhere from 12 to 20 weeks to rehire positions. And right now, our projection is between now and, say, the kind of full opening of the theaters in a 6 to 9 month range, we're looking at hiring upwards of 80, 90 positions.
6 to 9 months. So, you know, I was sort of thinking that maybe September, when a typical fall season for a theater or other arts organizations and rolls around, that you might be ready. But that sounds like that's going to be tough to meet.
It will be tough, but we're going to do a rolling basis as much as we can. So that 6 to 9 months includes, you know, we have three major venues. To open them all in the same month might be too heavy a lift for anybody, right? It's difficult to give each attention and each group of workers the attention they need to support reopening. So we hope to roll out the theaters in a way that makes sense.
You know, I follow what goes on in Las Vegas with their live productions, and their performing arts center, you know, isn't up at this point, of course, but they are doing distanced, smaller productions using larger rooms where people can be distanced, things like that. If that can be done in Las Vegas, which to my knowledge doesn't have a lower rate of COVID-19 than the greater Los Angeles area, why can't theater here, you know, particularly in a larger venue, let's say the Amundsen, where you use social distancing, why are you not allowed to do that?
You know, it's a great question. I think we are just on the list of folks who will get those guidelines at some point. Hopefully, we've heard sooner rather than later. I think right now we don't have them yet, which is why it is restrictively shut down. People have to be really thoughtful about how we do this safely. I think we will soon see some opportunities at earlier tiers for our theaters to reopen under some reduced capacity. Though we, you know, contrary to some Las Vegas theaters and, you know, some folks on Broadway like Hamilton, their cost structures are really different and they might be able to afford opening at severe reduced audience rates. And we're not seeing that as easily feasible for us.
Okay. That you just, the costs would so outstrip what you could collect in ticket revenue that you couldn't sustain that yet.
No, not in a long-term sense. Are we willing to do it as a reopening tool? Absolutely looking at that, of course.
All right. We're talking with the CEO and Managing Director of Center Theater Group in Los Angeles, Megan Pressman. Also joining me, Ben Guillory, co-founder, CEO, Producing Artistic Director of the Roby Theater Company, which stages its productions at the L.A. Theater Center downtown. Mr. Guillory, thank you for being with us. What sort of a timeline are you looking at for your production entity?
Well, thanks for having me, Larry, and it's great to be on with Paula and Megan and Gil, because we're all, of course, part of the theater community here in Los Angeles. Timeline. Well, at first, I had thought, yes, spring, September, but because of all of the variables and the changing landscape because of COVID and now the vaccine, I'm not sure. I'm simply not sure. I speculate that by January, hopefully, we will be able to produce theater in the traditional manner. I hope. But there is so much that can change. So much has changed. We now are preparing in a way that we are developing new work. Our Playwrights Laboratory is developing new work. We have 12 playwrights that we work with, commissioning new work so that when the time comes, we are ready to produce original new work, which is what we do, the Roby Theater Company. Roby was Paul Robeson's athletic nickname, and he's the inspiration for the Roby.
I wondered about that. That's very nice to hear. What about the L.A. Theater Center itself? To your knowledge, is it being outfitted with the kinds of filters and other things necessary to be able to welcome people back to indoor performances?
The Latino Theater Company, which is the host theater of the city-owned property, the Los Angeles Theater Center, is working on all of that. But remember, there are five theaters in the Los Angeles Theater Center, three Lord Houses and two Black Boxes. We operate out of the Black Box, the Roby Theater Company does, out of the Black Box, which is about 70 to 80 seats, depending on the demands of the set. And so, and of course, like most nonprofits, we get a lion's share of our budget through public funding.
Yeah.
Our box office, if we needed to depend on our box office, well, that wouldn't work well.
Sure.
That wouldn't work well.
We're talking with Ben Guillory of the Roby Theater Company. Also joining us, the managing director and co-CEO of South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa, Paula Tomei. Ms. Tomei, good to have you with us. What's going on right now with South Coast Rep in preparation for reopening later this year?
Well, first, thank you, Larry, for having me on, and I'm so happy to be on with three colleagues who, you know, we're all experiencing all of this together and learning from each other throughout it. At South Coast Rep right now, like most, we are remote, and this moment of digital has been the way to stay connected with audiences. At this moment, we are actually getting ready to film a Theater for Young Audiences production of a two-person Red Riding Hood by Alison Gregory, which the reason we're doing it is so that we can stream it to schools in Orange County, because typically we bring in about 10,000 kids from across the county to see live theater about throughout the season in a Theater for Young Audiences series. So the schools are also losing a lot around arts education and anything artistic to offer to the students. And so this was one of the moments we decided to take, and our board decided to take, to connect with the schools. The Pacific Playwrights Festival, which is typically held in April over a weekend and involves five new play readings and two full productions, is also going virtual with play readings, five play readings of new plays that will be distributed from April through June. And it will also be recorded. Now, this is, you know, that moment where we're not a film company, but we are hiring a film crew mm-hmm. to get the best quality out of these moments, which are, it's challenging to do everything on Zoom and to actually come across. So we're hopeful that those will keep our audiences connected in that way. And as has been mentioned by Megan, the protocols to do this have been extremely expensive and required by the union, the Actors Equity Association, of course, to keep people safe. And that said, you know, it's not sustainable, obviously. It's too much in terms of what we can continue to do in the long term.
Just real briefly, because I need to take a break, but do you have a date in mind when you're hoping to have a first indoor production with an audience?
We are hoping that will be in the fall sometime, probably October.
All right. And I assume you have all these sorts of hiring challenges and all as well with bringing in the kinds of experienced and trained professionals in theater to do that work. That's Paula Tomei, Managing Director and Co-CEO of South Coast Repertory in Costa Mesa. We'll continue talking about the state of the arts, local theater in Los Angeles in just a couple of minutes. It's State of the Arts, our series over the next couple of weeks looking at arts and entertainment and the timeline of return to stages and other production spaces. We've been hearing from Ben Guillory, who is the co-founder, CEO, and producing artistic director of the Roby Theater Company, which is based at the LA Theater Center in downtown Los Angeles, South Coast Rep's managing director and co-CEO Paula Tomei, and Megan Pressman, who's the managing director and CEO of Center Theater Group, their three venues, the Amundsen, the Taper, and the Douglas Theaters. And, you know, Megan laid this out so well because of having to lay off all these people during the time when you couldn't do any productions. What it takes to ramp back up theater production with all the professionals that you need, not to mention all the COVID-19 precautions and procedures that you need to put into place. And then there's the question, of course, to what degree will audience members feel comfortable coming back to live stage productions? With us is the executive director of the Geffen Playhouse in Westwood, Gil Cates Jr. Thank you so much, Gil. Appreciate your being with us. What sort of a timeline are you looking at the Geffen?
Of course. Thanks, Larry. And thanks for the kind words about Gil Sr. before. I've heard yes. some of those interviews. So,
and I always love talking with your dad. It was just always a pleasure.
I appreciated hearing that. And it's great to be here with my fellow theater leaders. You know, it's interesting. there's the timeline, and then there's the issue which you just mentioned, which Megan brought up too, about laying off. The Geffen, we actually took, we kind of jumped in and did a little bit of an opposite approach, took a little bit of a chance, and started something that we hope to keep most of our employees working. And I'm, you know, Matt Shackman, the artistic director, my partner and I are really, you know, proud of the fact that we've been able to keep about 80 to 85% of our staff employed through our Geffen Stayhouse series. And that started May of 2020, where we've been doing live interactive shows. We announced another one today. That does not carry over to budget the theater for, you know, in a big way. And it's funny, in a way, we're almost like, we want to go sooner to keep, to be able to keep everybody working and to keep the staff engaged, to keep the audience engaged, to keep the, you know, the donors engaged. So it's like a similar outlook with a slightly different approach, and there's no wrong approach to anything. It's just the approach that the Geffen took in terms of when we hope to open. We hope to open this fall. You know, it's ironic. It's the codes and regulations that we follow, and I think Megan and everyone here will agree, from Equity and our other union partners, and in our case, UCLA, who actually owns the building, even though they don't, you know, run the theater, there are partners there. I would say our requirements, you know, what we're doing to our HVAC system, our testing, our screening, our PPE, are, I would confidently say, safer today than probably movie theaters, which, and other dining and other things. So it's an interesting, what we want to do right now as a community and as an organization is help inform political leadership and otherwise what we're working with and what we're working against, so they can make the best decision and understand how much we are adhering and trying to prepare and exceed, you know, how we're able to open. So it's an interesting...
I think we just lost there. We'll try and get back Gil Cates Jr., the executive director of the Geffen Playhouse in Westwood. In the meantime, let me take a call from Susan Lowenberg of LA Theater Works, which she founded and has been leading for decades. Susan, thank you for being with us. You have a survey of your audience that you conducted. Is that right?
We do. And Larry, thank you so much for saying just a decade. Unfortunately, it's been about 40 years.
I thought I said decades, plural, but I wasn't trying to shortchange you. I know it's more than 10 years.
But anyway, yes, we just completed a survey. Interestingly enough, 75% of the responses were comfortable coming back by January, and 45% of the responses were comfortable coming back in September.
That's terrific. So are you thinking seriously of having in-person performances by September?
Well, we are subject to whatever UCLA decides, because we are at the James Bridges Theater at UCLA. And so it really depends on them when they are comfortable opening. The kids are going to be back in school, some of them, according to UCLA, probably in the fall. But whether or not they decide to open the James Bridges or any of the other theaters is really up to them. So,
but if they open, you'd be ready to go?
We're ready to go if they're ready to go.
Susan, thank you so much, and we sure hope that that happens sooner rather than later. Also with us from the International City Theater in Long Beach, Karen, thank you very much. What are you doing looking forward to in-person performances?
Well, I'll tell you that we started planning in December 2020 and January 2021 and laid out a whole socially distancing seating plan so we would be ready. No one expected it was going to take this long, and you know, making sure we have masks and sanitizers and all those things. Our theater looks like the Mark Taper Forum, but my contract with Equity doesn't allow us to use all those seats. But if we're doing socially distanced, skipping rows and seats, then we can, you know, maybe not do as many seats as we normally could, but keep us going. And we had hoped, you know, we are, you know, like many of the theaters, we're doing virtual programming for our main stage. And even some of our education, we have the third grade in school program where they write plays and, you know, and we're still able to do that online. And our, because we have six education programs. But we were hoping, you know, because we work on a calendar year, so we were hoping that we could do the August-September show live and October-November show live. But I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you raised this. This is Karen Desai, by the way, of International City Theater in Long Beach. You bring up this issue of the calendar and the planning, because I know for theaters like yours where you have loyal, you know, people and some subscribe to the productions and all, you really count on that, and that's a you know, a huge issue. Karen, let me just go back to Gil Cates Jr. at the Geffen. I think we got that connection straightened out. Gil, just real quickly, you have a subscription series. You have, you know, regular subscribers. What do you do if you can't plan that you're going to have a subscription season?
First of all, I apologize.
Oh, that's
a rookie, a rookie cell phone to computer airwave mistake.
No problem.
I mean, that's part of the key is like how we are, the shows that we are going to put up. You know, if you look at the recent, which I like to think it's going to change, and that's what I was just starting to say before about informing leaders so they really understand what we're doing, and then they can make the best decision possible, and then we'll be good with it. We just want to make sure they know, because if you looked at, you know, equity and other, you know, rules, they're very, you know, in a good way, they're very strong. And I think, but to go back to your question about, I think that you, if we were looking at the way it is today, which is, you know, no shows can happen indoors, you know, until tiers are, there aren't even tiers, which again, I know at the Geffen, we have a hard time with that concept, knowing what else is open and opening.
Yeah.
But we will make smart choices in terms of what we program, how, what the budget is of, you know, our first show compared to the different capacity limits that we might learn about in the coming months. And at the same time, be prepared to, you know, keep the Stay House series going and other things, because I think the most important thing is the engagement.
I appreciate it, Gil. Sorry I'm out of time. Megan, Ben, Paula, thank you all so much. Susan and Karen for calling in as well on Air Talk.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.